From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. As state legislators and the federal government push to do something, anything, about the opioid epidemic that continues to kill thousands, the pharmaceutical companies that sell prescription opioids continue to push against restrictions. In fact, the opioid lobby is spending more than eight times the American gun lobby. All this comes to light as reporters dig into documents that show how prescription opioids were aggressively and misleadingly pushed onto the American public and health system from the very beginning of our opioid crisis. This hour on Point, pharmaceutical companies' historic and continued role in the opioid addiction epidemic. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Is this your story, your family's story? And doctors, how do you feel about how opioids have been sold? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later this hour, we'll look at how the sugar industry secretly funded a study that downplayed the relationship between sugar and heart disease. But joining me first in our studio is David Armstrong, senior enterprise reporter for Stat News, author of the new investigation Secret Trove Reveals Bold Crusade to Make OxyContin a Blockbuster. David Armstrong, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
You got these facts and details out of the documents that came in the midst of legislation. There's been a lot of legislation. How is new information still coming to light a dozen or more years after this big push was made to sell OxyContin to Americans?
Well, Tom, what actually happened here is we were able to get these records from a court case in West Virginia. And one of the reasons you're seeing a lot of reporting now on sort of the history of how this drug was marketed is Purdue Pharma and its partner in the early days, Abbott Laboratories, were very successful in keeping these records sealed and confidential when they were settling court cases.
Purdue developed OxyContin.
That's correct.
Abbott marketed OxyContin.
Alongside Purdue.
Okay.
So in this case, these were records that were contained in a case in West Virginia, which has been particularly hard hit by the opioid epidemic.
Terrible. Just devastating for many communities there.
The entire state, really. It's an incredible place. So we along with others, have been asking judges to unseal these records and let us look at them, and that's how we're learning new things about how these drugs were marketed.
Why would they have been so eager to keep secret what was in these documents about their business practices?
Well, because frankly, some of the practices were unseemly and, as we later learned, illegal.
Like what?
Well, for instance, they were misrepresenting the addictive nature of the drug. And this was a concern of physicians because the active ingredient in OxyContin is oxycodone. It's an opioid. It can be addictive. And OxyContin was a new kind of drug. It was pure oxycodone. It was nothing else combined with it. And as we learned, this was quite a revelation for drug users because the high they got from this drug was unlike any other painkiller before.
It was a painkiller, but it came with a high. A lot of people could not let go of that. Did Purdue and did Abbott know that it was more addictive than they were telling the medical world?
That's a tricky question. What the federal government found when they settled with Purdue in 2007 is they were making representations that are not backed by science. And that is, for instance, it's less addictive than shorter-acting painkillers or that the rates of addiction were not what they said. So hard to know how much they knew, but we do know that they misrepresented to doctors what they thought or were representing was fact.
Before long, they were selling a lot of this. They were making billions, and they were being sued all over the place. We're talking about, I don't know, more than 1,000 cases here where Purdue, again, those who developed OxyContin and really pushed it, they were paying 70 law firms in 1,400 cases, law firms billing 1.2 million hours of work. That's just colossal. What were they defending themselves against?
Well, they had a product that was very successful. They were defending their corporate life is what it came down to.
But what was the threat? What was the charge? What would have been what would have cut their business?
Well, what would have cut their business is that this drug can be misused and it can be terribly addictive for some people. And we know that certain areas of the country were ravaged by this drug. Not only were people addicted, but keep in mind, Tom, This unleashed crime waves. People would do anything they could to get this drug. Pharmacists were putting in bulletproof glass. FedEx trucks were being knocked off, not for jewelry or other products, but for OxyContin. So the impact of this was incredible. So they were protecting a franchise.
You write about how they did Abbott marketing on Purdue's behalf, had all kinds of kind of crazy techniques for getting doctors to pick this stuff up and push it.
Right. So one of the things that was revealing about the Abbott documents in particular is the techniques they were using. So for instance, they just wanted to get a couple minutes of a doctor's time. So they would arrange to meet doctors at their favorite restaurant to pay for their takeout food. And while they're waiting for the doctor to get their food and for the drug company to pay for it, they were selling them an OxyContin. And then there was this case we wrote about in which a doctor was not giving the reps any time.
Yeah.
They found out from his staff he had a sweet tooth. So the next week they come back with a big sheet cake full of donuts and snack cakes spelled out to in the word OxyContin. Next thing you know, doctor's very interested.
Donuts spelling out OxyContin. And the next thing you know, we have a national crisis really around this. But were they pushing addiction in the way, I don't know, two centuries ago, opium dealers were hooking China on opium? You know, is this evil big pharma trying to get America hooked and overdosed and dead and ravaged? Or were they simply trying to fight pain with a new drug?
Well, I mean, that's a question you'd have to ask them.
I'm asking you because you're the reporter. We know what they'll say.
Yes, we do. Look, they were selling a product. They believed that it was an effective painkiller. What they did was downplay, diminish, dismiss the risk, which were serious here. The risks of addiction, of what would happen to people who took this drug if not properly monitored, if not given the right dosage. And that's really where I think the offensive activity occurred.
David Armstrong, please stand by. Senior enterprise reporter for Stat News with me in the studio. With us right now from Los Angeles is Matt Late, an editor at the Los Angeles Times. He oversaw the LA Times public records investigation into Purdue Pharma, the developer of OxyContin, and it was quite an investigation. Matt Late, thank you for joining us. Welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
What's the biggest finding that you pulled out of your very deep research, Matt?
Well, I think, first of all, I want to commend David and Stat News for the work they've done. They've done terrific work getting records unsealed. Our investigation was based on a lot of internal Purdue documents as well that were slipped to us and came from other sources. And I think the big finding that we had was, while there was a lot of focus on Purdue Pharma downplaying the risk of addiction, ours kind of went at the heart of the drug, which was its bold claim that it lasted 12 hours, you know, it provided 12 hours of pain relief for patients. And we looked through a lot of clinical studies, court records, et cetera, to show that for many patients, that claim just isn't true.
Why did that matter? Why does it matter? Why would it matter, Matt?
It's a huge issue because that the 12-hour claim is what gives Purdue Pharma its marketing advantage over generics, which, you know, would cost significantly less than what they were able to charge for their drug that provided 12 hours of relief.
Cost is one thing. An opioid crisis is another. Is there a connection between misrepresenting the duration of its effectiveness and the crisis that we have on our hands right now nationally?
Absolutely. The 12-hour, because it didn't last 12 hours for many patients, that created a kind of a roller coaster of a withdrawal between your next dose. And that also kind of fostered addiction for many patients. Without that 12-hour claim, insurers would be less likely to pay for those drugs. They would just go to a generic that would last 8 hours.
What's the bottom line here? Do you believe that these pharmaceutical companies were pushing addiction on America?
I think it was all, profit generated. They were motivated by the money. I don't know if
So was the heroin trade. So was the opium trade back in the day. Was this different?
Well, we do have internal records and emails and documents showing that Purdue executives knew that it didn't last 12 hours. In fact, their studies showed that even before they went to market. And when they saw doctors prescribing OxyContin for frequencies 8 hours, 6 hours, they refocused their sales force to get doctors off that prescribing pattern and refocus them back on 12-hour dosing.
Are they facing legal challenges or consequences for this alleged misrepresentation now, Matt?
Well, I know that there's been calls for investigations from lawmakers to have the FDA, and frankly, we did another one about Purdue Pharma and what it knew about black market sales of its drugs, though the DEA is also being asked to investigate. Where this goes from here, from David's reporting and the other guests you're going to have on shortly, I mean, that remains to be seen.
Does this still matter, Matt, in a time when a lot of the action has moved on to illegal drugs, fentanyl and other, like what may have killed Prince and others? Do the prescription drugs still matter?
Yes, absolutely. I think many people are still using OxyContin. It's millions of people, and it's still a huge moneymaker. The problem, a lot of the problems that you're seeing with heroin stem from originally being on a prescription painkiller, and then they transition into the cheaper heroin.
David, do you still see the legal pharmaceuticals driving something down in the engine of our opioid crisis?
Yeah, I think Matt makes a really excellent point, and that is prescription painkillers are a gateway to heroin. There's been government studies that show 4 in 5 new heroin users started out misusing prescription painkillers. So the problem we have today with heroin and fentanyl has its roots in prescription painkillers, and that's why it's so relevant and important today.
David Armstrong with Stat News. Please stand by. Matt Late, an editor at the Los Angeles Times, has been right in the middle of their big investigative push on this front. Matt, thank you very much for joining us from Los Angeles today.
My pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about how America was sold on opioids, OxyContin, and more, the pharmaceutical industry, and our age of addiction. We really are in it. It's now killed more than 165,000 people through overdose since the year 2000 and left millions more hooked. Communities devastated by this. It started out with pain relief as the sort of big banner under which it was sold. There's a lot of investigation that has gone on and continues now to go on this front. David Armstrong with Stat News is with us. He's been writing about the crusade to, that's what it was called, the crusade. They called the salespeople crusaders to sell this deeply into the American medical system. And we have seen what has unfolded since. You can join us this hour. What do you think? Has the opioid crisis, well, this you would just know, has it hit you? Has it hit your family, your community? And is it fair to ask, did these big pharmaceutical companies plant the seeds, fan the flames for billions? Have you seen the lobbying, the campaigning still going on to block efforts to rein in opioid use, abuse? I mean, you can hear this kind of thing all over the country now, but just listen. Last year, former prescription pills and heroin addict Dana Murrell talked with KRCR News, the ABC affiliate in Northern California, about how she moved from OxyContin to heroin.
I first started doing it, pills. It's when the OxyContins came out. And the pills were so available, but they got expensive. So then what happened is heroin was just cheaper. So addictive, because once you start coming down from that high and you don't have it, you start to get sick. And you get physically sick. And so the only thing that's going to make you better is if you do more.
You think that sounds bad? Once you're addicted, it can get really ugly. Here's an interview from Al Jazeera America. This is in January. A group of men at a sober home in Bangor, Maine, describing, and brace yourself here, this is a little rough, but describing the lengths that they went to get prescription drugs to feed their addictions.
One time I was hurting so bad that I ended up punching a 4x4 and breaking all three of these fingers in this bone to get pain meds from my doctor. I did that several times.
So you'd hurt yourself in order to
absolutely
go to a doctor?
I had 9 teeth pulled out of my head for prescriptions. At the time, that's how
to
my
to get a prescription.
Yeah. I've been with like groups of people where they've taken like bats to their wrists.
Broke arms.
Take a bat to your wrist to break the arm. 9 teeth pulled for prescriptions here. David Armstrong, it's great to have you right here. I want to welcome into our conversation as well right now Ben Weider, reporter for the Center for Public Integrity, co-author of a big series with the Associated Press focusing on the pharmaceutical industry's political efforts. Ben Weider in Washington, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
The numbers that you and David lay out are kind of incredible here. Sales of these opioids, legal prescription drugs, quadrupling from 99 to 2010. Overdose deaths rising just as fast, up to 165,000 this millennium. You remind us, last year, this is just blows my mind, 227 million opioid prescriptions doled out in the U.S., you write, enough to hand a bottle of pills to 9 out of every 10 American adults. And you've got here profits revenues of $2.4 billion from opioids alone last year from Purdue Pharma, who came up with this. You describe how they are still aggressively defending their sort of pushing of this into the American medical system. Ben, what's the picture there?
Purdue Pharma, yeah, what we dug into in doing our investigation was we tried to get a sense of, you know, what was going on with legislators, what was going on with regulators, as there was this growing awareness of, you know, an opioid crisis fueling a heroin crisis. You know, we were curious what were legislators doing, what were regulators doing during this time period. And what we found was, you know, the scale of activity by pharmaceutical companies such as Purdue and their allies. We dug into an organization called the Pain Care Forum, which was essentially a trade group for the opioid industry. It was Purdue Pharma. Their lobbyist was a co-founder of it, a bunch of other pharmaceutical companies, and a bunch of related nonprofits that, you know, received funding from pharmaceutical companies or for other reasons were connected to the industry. And they pumped, you know, in terms of what we found, they pumped $880 million into their influence efforts, both in terms of campaign contributions and lobbying at both the state and federal level over a 10-year period.
What kind of legislation were they trying, apparently, or appear to be trying, to have been trying to waylay, stop, water down?
So there's all sorts of things that states have considered as they've tried to grapple with this problem, whether it be imposing limits, saying that you can only write a first prescription for pills for a certain number of days. You can't prescribe it for too many days because then you might, you know, patients might wind up having extra pills left over after their pain has passed, which is, you know, a common way that people wind up getting hooked. You know, the pain has stopped, but the pills still feel pretty good. Other efforts are, you know, related to use of electronic monitoring systems, where basically you can kind of track whether patients are getting prescriptions from multiple places. And there are different rules on the books as to, you know, whether doctors are required to check these directories to see if, you know, a patient coming to them has gotten prescriptions from elsewhere. And so there's all sorts of regulations related to that. You know, how do doctors have to check them? How quickly does a pharmacy have to notify the system that a patient has come in for a prescription? So there's any number of things that are out there that states are dealing with to try to deal with this problem. And from the pharmaceutical industry's perspective, these changes are going to, you know, affect their bottom line. You know, if a doctor can only prescribe for 3 days rather than, you know, 2 weeks, well, that's fewer pills. That means less money.
But of course, I guess it's the pills that you don't need, David Armstrong, for the immediate pain after some operation, whatever it might be, that tend to end up getting people in trouble.
Yeah, and this is a common route, not only for people that get the prescription, but for others who misuse them to get the drugs. They're laying around. Grandma's got
Aunt
extra.
Sally had them, and there they are, and here we go. Let's party.
Yeah, and that is a very common route, especially with the long-term, you know, 30, 60-day prescriptions. You know, people might only need it for a couple of days, and you have all these extra drugs.
But what about that need? I mean, Ben Weider's writing about this. You're writing about it. Are you guys just heartless reporters who don't get that there's real pain out there and people need drugs to fight that?
There's certainly people with real pain, and I hear from them. I'm sure the other reporters hear from them as well. The question is, are there that many people? You mentioned this 227 million prescriptions
that
have this amount of pain.
That's 1 year.
1 year.
9 out of 10 American adults could each have a bottle off that. Do we all need to be on painkillers?
And the rate of prescribing in the United States so far outpaces anywhere else in the world. The only place that's close is Canada.
I read somewhere, I think we use 2/3 of all the painkillers in the world. We're, what, 5% of the global population?
Right. So clearly some other parts of the world are underserved when it comes to pain, but are we in that much more pain in this country? It's hard to believe.
Chris in Fort Collins, Colorado. Thank you for calling, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to share my personal story with this. I have a very close relative to me that she's been taking painkillers for about 20 years. I think when she first started, she was in a car accident, and it was just a minor fender bender, but she complained about neck pain. But it's been clear to us that she doesn't have any neck pain anymore. We've taken her to MRIs and x-rays. The problem is that she still takes the pills, and her doctor prescribes them. She comes in for an appointment, and they don't really even talk. He just writes down what he wants to give her, and then she gets, you know, about, I'd say, 40 pills at a time.
Has it affected her life? And if so, in a good way or a bad way, Chris?
Oh, it's definitely really negative. She has to take the pills. If she doesn't take them, I'd say every 6 hours, she turns into kind of a nasty woman. And, you know, it's kind of a taboo subject in our family, but we've kind of learned to live with it. We've tried to tell her that, you know, she needs to stop, but she's never going to. And as long as she's got a doctor prescribing them, she's going to keep going back.
Chris, I really appreciate your call. Ben, it's infuriating when you hear a situation like that, and it's repeated, you know, millions of times, I guess. But how far and how can we fairly go in criticizing a pharmaceutical company for coming up with a pain reliever? I mean, is it fair to say they could imagine a country addicted and what a moneymaker that would be?
I think it's important to think about, you know, the situation that Chris was describing. And you have to think about, you know, from a doctor's perspective, you know, there's a balance that you always have to strike with these drugs. As David mentioned earlier, I mean, these are very addictive drugs. Everyone knows that. And so there's a balance you're striking between curing pain, treating pain, and dealing with the risks of addiction.
We do not say that with heroin. We don't say, well, there's a balance here. The guy needs his heroin. We just say that's bad.
We wouldn't, yeah. I mean, of course, we've decided that heroin, you know, is too dangerous. But you know, there's responsible ways, I think, to use these drugs for sure. But to some extent, and this is where the pharmaceutical companies come into play. It's partially about how you frame thinking about the treatment. You know, it used to be that opioids were kind of a last line of treatment. If you were in serious pain, if you were a cancer patient, you were going to get opioids. But if you just had, you know, back pain, your doctor wasn't going to give you opioids. That just didn't happen. Pharmaceutical companies and allies of theirs have kind of helped to push an idea that, you know, the appropriate way to deal with pain, all ranges of pain, is with opiates. And that is a big shift. And that is, I think, the point where you say, what role have they played in this? No one is saying, I think, that, you know, that there aren't appropriate uses for opioids. The question is just, you know, are they being used appropriately right now? Are there people who are given opioids who really don't need them in the first place?
I mean, but the maybe larger question that you guys raised collectively, David, almost all of these reports, is did the industry understand the limits of good use and push beyond them deliberately?
I'm not sure the answer to that, but the point that Ben makes is a good one, and that is they created an environment that changed the thinking of physicians that this controlled substance should be the first line of defense when it comes to pain. And that was a shift, a paradigm shift.
We've got communities coming apart. We've got a country in trouble over this. I mean, this has happened in history. China was hooked on opium very deliberately by Britain. American traders were in there as well, shipping it up. And it almost feels like, from the inside, something not entirely different.
Well, the results are certainly very similar, that's for sure. But what I think we had here is for-profit companies pushing their drugs and doing whatever it took to make these blockbusters. And boy, did they make them blockbusters.
Marjorie in Burlington, Vermont. Thank you for calling, Marjorie. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom. I'm calling from Burlington, Vermont. I lost my son to a heroin overdose based on addiction due to an ACL surgery and also a traumatic brain surgery. And two different accidents, and it escalated to heroin based on the painkillers he was given. He was addicted rather quickly because of the strength of these painkillers. He was addicted at 19, virtually right off. These painkillers are incredibly strong and incredibly dangerous. And to even question if the pharmaceutical companies are not aware of the fact that this is happening, it's an insane situation.
I mean, just look at the news.
119.
Yeah.
119 overdoses a day. I'm a chapter leader of GRASP, Grieving Recovery After a Substance Passing, in Vermont. The epidemic is horrendous. My son died in Portland, Maine, in a sober house after 6 or 7 rehabs. I can't even count them. And fighting these painkillers initially, and then the last year it escalated to heroin and it killed him.
Sorry, Marjorie.
And I was wondering, is there not a class action suit? It's not really my nature to even think that way, but why aren't these people accountable? Big Tobacco was held accountable. I don't understand why there's even a doubt that these people are criminals. You know, virtually it's all about money. They have no interest nobody needs these kinds of painkillers. You know, why are they not accountable?
Marjorie,
why aren't there class action suits?
We hear it, and I'll ask it, and I'm so sorry for the loss of your son. I mean, that's just unimaginable pain, and I'm really sorry for it. I'm glad that you're out there campaigning on this and looking for answers. David Benn, I'll come first to you. David, what about it? Class action suit here? Should there be? I'm looking. I've got just from the last day or two, here's suits that are being filed in Maryland, Alabama, Minnesota, Pennsylvania. Is the equivalent of what Marjorie's calling for underway or not?
Sort of. And Marjorie, I'm also sorry to hear about your experience. It's horrible. And I've talked to families and the impact.
So
it's just devastating and it's hard to listen to. The federal government actually went after Purdue, and Purdue pled guilty, a subsidiary of Purdue, pled guilty to a federal crime of misbranding their drug and paid over $600 million in fines.
This was 2007,
right? So this is the reckoning, such as it is. Three executives pled guilty to charges but never served a day in jail. The company never lost the right to sell the drug.
And they're still making billions a year.
They paid a tax. They paid a cost of doing business. It was the $600 million fine, because other than that, frankly, there was no change in business until 2010 when they came out with a new version of the drug. But this is 15 years after the drug's been on the market.
Ben, do you see some greater legal recourse here along the lines that Marjorie describes after having lost her son?
I mean, I would agree with David in that, you know, we're seeing, you know, to some extent, I mean, the reason why we, you know, have some of the documents that we've used in our reporting is because of the suits that have been brought against Purdue and some of these other companies. So clearly there are some actions that are being taken against them. But, you know, it is important to remember, you know, that the fines that they're paying, the amounts that they're spending do pale in comparison to the profits that they're making. And you know, you could understand that they may see this as just sort of a reasonable cost of doing business. You know, you pay a fine or, you know, in our case, you know, when we were looking at contributions, I mean, the amounts that they're spending on these things seem eye-popping until you remember that they're a drop in the bucket compared to the actual sales that these companies are making.
So they're still out there fighting legislative efforts at the state level across the country to try and put more speed bumps in front of these prescriptions in use.
It's true. I mean, in Massachusetts, where you're based, you know, this year there was an effort to put a prescription limit that would say that you could, you know, for a first prescription, you can only have it for 3 days. You know, their allies were able to push for that to be extended to 7 days. This is a fight they're fighting in, you know, pretty much everywhere in the country. You know, as new laws come out, as agencies try to push regulations, they're pushing back against them. They're not necessarily, you know, completely killing them everywhere, but, you know, they might, you know, slightly water down the requirements. And in essence, you know, keep the sales going.
This On Point podcast and following message are brought to you by Goldman Sachs. For answers to the world's most pressing economic questions, from the future of finance to the disruptive potential of artificial intelligence, tune in to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, the firm's podcast. Each episode features in-depth discussions with some of the firm's leading experts on the markets, evolving industries, and the global economy. Subscribe to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs on iTunes, Stitcher, or SoundCloud, or listen at gs.com/podcast.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about how America was sold on opioids, OxyContin and more, the pharmaceutical industry, and our age of addiction. Look around. It is out there. 165,000 deaths from overdose just since the year 2000. Millions more hooked. Communities in trouble. David Armstrong is with us, senior reporter at Stat News. They've been digging deeply into this. Ben Weider with us as well from the Center for Public Integrity. They've both done yeoman's work in bringing out documents that show how aggressively these drugs were marketed by pharmaceutical companies right through the main legal channels. Some of that, surely and certainly, for pain, but look around now. We've got a big problem. Here was President Obama talking at a panel on the National Prescription Drug Abuse and Heroin Summit. This was in Atlanta in March, saying that given the cost to families and communities, Americans have to see the opioid epidemics as one of the country's top priorities.
It has to be something that is right up there at the top of our radar screen. You mentioned the number 28,000. It's important to recognize that today we are seeing more people killed because of opioid overdose than traffic accidents.
Think about that. And that's just death. There's a lot of destruction that goes on well before it gets to the overdose and the death. Lots of response online, and of course, we're always paying big attention to all of the digital fronts here, Twitter and Facebook and our website at On Point Radio. Check them out. Participate there anytime, 24 hours a day. Garrett writes to us, "My hometown of Plattsburgh, New York, has been completely rocked by the opioid epidemic in recent years. Personally," he says, "I've lost several close friends to addiction and overdose. The pharmaceutical industry," he writes, "has destroyed this country." It's a big charge. I mean, people have had pain eased as well, but a lot of skepticism out there. Kent writes right now on Facebook. He says people should be allowed to sue their doctors if their doctor prescribed OxyContin to them and they later become addicts. We'll talk about that. But Rob says, be careful to avoid hysteria on this. My wife uses OxyContin for chronic pain that she will likely have until she dies. She's not addicted. She's never increased her usage, but she absolutely needs this to make her life bearable. Let me get one call right here, David and Ben. Gloria in Swansea, South Carolina. Gloria, you're on. Thanks for calling.
Thank you very much. I am objecting to the talk about opioids. Let's get rid of them. They're killing people. They're overdosing. These people who are overdosing are suicidal. And they should not have been given them by their doctor. A doctor has to know what's going on with each patient. And all of a sudden, we are not able to have palliative care. I'm 78. I'm in chronic pain.
Yep.
And I can't get anything for it except off the drugstore shelves. And they don't work. Now, I'm not the only aged person who is left behind. We go to the doctors, and they refuse to do anything. They say, you go to our pain management clinic. Well, I think everybody ought to see who is on the board of that pain management clinic. They are getting some money from that, I'm sure.
So what you want is relief. You want your opioids, Gloria.
I certainly do, and I'm not the only one.
But what about 165,000 people dead since the year 2000? You call them all suicidal, really?
I think that's the key.
Gloria, I appreciate your call. David Armstrong, look, some people really need this. We're getting it online, and we're getting it from Gloria. She doesn't have it. But nationally, we've got a crisis here.
Yeah, I don't think anybody's calling for a complete prohibition on these,
of course not,
on these drugs. They're calling for rational, informed prescription of them in a more controlled way. So in Massachusetts now, we have limits on how many days supply you can prescribe.
Yeah.
You have to go back and see the doctor.
Yeah.
So nobody wants to see somebody suffering. Nobody wants to see that. But what has to happen, and I think what politicians across the country have now realized is we have to be a lot smarter about this and a lot more on top of who's getting them and for how long.
Sarah in Fort Collins, Colorado. Sarah, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
So I'm a physician assistant in Colorado, and I frequently prescribe opioids, even though I don't want to. And the thing that I'm hearing that is, or that I'm not hearing, is the role that insurance companies play. My hands are frequently tied in how I can care for a patient. One, because in your urgent care and your emergency room setting, your reimbursement is partly based on your patient satisfaction. My patients aren't satisfied until their pain is taken care of.
Or maybe they're not satisfied unless their addiction is fed, Sarah.
Well, but I have patients that aren't addicted, that come in after a car accident or after a sports injury that are in excruciating pain. And if I could get them to give me 1 week of joint injections, chiropractic care, acupuncture, physical therapy, I could have them out of pain. But the insurance companies won't let me get their patient into physical therapy.
They just say, give them the opioids and be done with it.
They do, because I have to get prior authorization, and that can take a month.
Sarah, our time is short here, but I really appreciate that perspective. Patient satisfaction comes in here as well. Ben Weider, you know, if David Armstrong's right, I mean, you hear what Sarah's describing in the front lines there. David says we need rational, controlled distribution for the right reasons. But if Big Pharma, you describe them in there spending millions to keep legislators from moving forward on these programs, are we going to get that, even as we appear to sink more deeply into this opioid crisis?
Well, it's a gradual process, and it's interesting what Sarah raised, because I think she raised 2 points that are pretty relevant, which is that, you know, in some cases, doctors in certain states, if they didn't want to prescribe opioids to a patient, their hands were kind of tied by laws that had been passed earlier that in many cases had been pushed by pharmaceutical companies, saying that if they weren't going to write a prescription, that they had to pass the patient on to a doctor who would. So that's one thing which I think is
pretty,
you know, has made a challenge in certain states. But I think the second part, in terms of thinking about alternatives, you know, is an important one. This year, the CDC issued some guidelines on dealing with opioids, and, you know, and David alluded to this earlier. A key was thinking of opioids not as the first line, thinking of alternative treatments that are available. And, you know, with those guidelines out, maybe insurance companies will catch on and will say, we're going to support this.
We've got a situation here, the country trying to grapple with it. David Armstrong and Ben Weider looking at the pharmaceutical industry interests behind some very large portion of what's going on. Ben Weider at the Center for Public Integrity with us today from Washington. Thank you very much for your time. Thanks for joining us, Ben.
Thanks, Tom.
And David Armstrong at Stat News. Thanks for all your great reporting on this, and thanks for being with us today, David.
Thanks as well for having me.
In a moment, we look at how the sugar industry paid Harvard professors for a study that downplayed the relationship between sugar and heart disease. This is On Point. Earlier this month, new revelations out of the University of California, San Francisco show that the sugar industry secretly funded Harvard professors' research that cherry-picked data to suggest that fat, not sugar, was the main culprit in coronary heart disease. The research was decades ago, but it may still be driving how we understand heart health. Joining me now from New York to discuss the findings is Marion Nestle, professor of nutrition, food studies, and public health at New York University. Her most recent book is Soda Politics, Taking on Big Soda and Winning. Talk about sugar. Marion Nestle, welcome back to On Point.
Oh, glad to be here, and hi, Tom.
Hi. We wanted to catch up with how this news is going. It's a couple of weeks now since this news came out, and it was kind of a bombshell to many people. After all the years we spent with primary focus on fats, and how they contributed to heart disease, and of course they do, did sugar get a pass because they corrupted our understanding somehow of what was going on, what was understood scientifically?
Well, was extraordinary about this particular incident is that the documents that the UCSF investigators found made it very clear that the sugar industry knew exactly what it wanted from the research, that it paid investigators who they were pretty sure would produce the kind of evidence that they wanted, or at least the kind of review that they wanted, because those investigators were already very invested in the idea that saturated fat was a risk factor for heart disease. And the documents themselves are incredibly damning, and they certainly give more than the appearance of conflict of interest, if not conflict of interest itself. And this, of course, has continued all the way up to the present. We're still dealing with a lot of food industry-funded research that comes out, what a coincidence, with results that exactly favor the sponsor's interest.
How much influence can it have? I mean, we're talking all the way here back in the 1960s, and we're talking about essentially one set of research decades ago. How big a deal is that?
Well, it's hard to know exactly because it's all retrospective. But this was a two-part series. The reviews were a two-part series in the extremely prestigious New England Journal of Medicine in 1967. But they were part of a much larger body of research that was struggling to figure out what the role of sugar was in chronic disease risk. Sugar is calories, doesn't have any nutrients, and in small amounts, there's really nothing wrong with it. In large amounts, it causes problems. And it's very difficult to do the research that will demonstrate that sugar, as opposed to the foods that sugar is in or everything else everybody is eating, is the factor that's responsible for coronary heart disease risk. So there were big debates about it at the time, and indeed for the next 20 or 25 years. These reviews did not help clarify the issue. They clearly came out in favor of saturated fat as the risk factor, and the online analysis that the UCSF investigators did of the way in which the review dealt with the research is also quite damning, because any problems with the sugar research were brought up to the front and treated very seriously. Similar problems with the saturated fat research were treated much more gently.
Was this something deliberately conceived and foreseen by the sugar industry? Were they hunting for this kind of, I don't know if exoneration is the right word, but diversion from potential issues with sugar?
Oh, they saw saturated fat as a business opportunity. If you could deflect interest in risk factors, dietary risk factors for heart disease to saturated fat rather than sugar, then they could sell as much sugar into the food supply as the food supply could absorb. And, of course, that's what happened years later in the late 1980s and early 1990s when saturated fat was listed as the single most serious risk factor for heart disease. The food manufacturers began to produce products that had no fat in them but made up the calories and sugar. That's referred to as the Snackwells phenomenon, because Snackwells cookies were made without fat but had a lot of sugar in them, and they flew off the shelves. So it was a business opportunity. And the sugar industry, the documents show that the sugar industry was very deliberately looking for a prestigious place to put in a review from prestigious investigators that would exonerate sugar, and they got it, and they paid the equivalent of nearly $50,000 in today's dollars to do that. That doesn't look good.
Was there any transparency about that payment at the time? Was it known that they were paid by the sugar industry to publish this?
No, it wasn't. I mean, that was the really bad part. The New England Journal of Medicine articles, the New England Journal of Medicine did not require investigators to state who their funding sources were until 1984. This was 1967. But it was customary at the time for investigators to thank the funders of their studies, and it was quite customary to list whoever had funded it. And in this particular case, the investigators listed several sources. And if you knew who those sources were, one of them was the Harvard Fund for Research, and another one was something called the Nutrition Foundation. If you knew that both of these were funded by the food industry, then you would know that these investigators were taking money that had been laundered from the food industry to pay for their research. But they didn't mention the Sugar Research Foundation. I guess they forgot.
We got one of the researchers writing to the sugar executives. We are all well aware of your particular interest, and we'll cover this as well as we can. I'm sure that was comforting. What have we learned, though, in the years since? Is it a fair question to say which is worse, fat or sugar, when it comes to coronary heart disease?
Well, I look at both saturated fat and sugars as being taken out of the dietary and the caloric context. Most people don't eat sugar on its own, and nobody eats saturated fat on its own because all food fats are mixtures.
Yeah, but our food is loaded with it. Which is more dangerous? Is sugar dangerous in heart health terms?
Oh, you can't say that. There's no way to answer that question.
Why not? Has the research not been done?
It's not possible to do the research. You need to know what else everybody else is eating. You can't do that kind of research. You can't look at sugar independently of what's in the diet, and you can't look at saturated fat independently of what's in the diet.
Have there been consequences, then, for this diversion of attention away from fat, or toward fat and away from sugar? I mean, maybe it didn't matter.
Well, I don't think there's any question about that, but these studies were only part of a much larger picture. Sugar is fine in small quantities. The minute you start eating large quantities of sugar, you're taking in more calories than you need, you're stressing the body's metabolic system, and you're doing all kinds of things that aren't good. Sugar's fine in small amounts.
Is the danger mainly about obesity, or is it about the stressing on the system that you described there?
Well, I think it's both. Certainly, obesity itself is a risk factor for type 2 diabetes and heart disease, but there may be independent components of large amounts of sugar. Certainly, that's seen with the soft drink research, which is the easiest way to research this because there are people who drink so much. Soft drinks, which has sugars, water, and nothing else of redeeming nutritional value. So the bottom line on this is everybody would be healthier eating less sugar, or most people would be healthier. Some people don't eat very much. Those people are fine. But for people who consume a lot of soft drinks or desserts, which are the main sources, eating less is probably a good idea.
And paying attention to the research that comes our way and who funds it. Marion Nestle at New York University, always great to have you. Thank you for joining us.
Glad to be here.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.